Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker State Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I'm really stoked to get on the line Randy Burtis, formerly from Wyoming and now residing in Montana, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Randy?
That's correct. I'm in Great Falls, Montana now.
Excellent. All right. So kind of dating back a little bit, when I first started looking in Colorado for a place to live, we started down in Durango. And then once we decided that wasn't going to be our permanent home down there, we started looking, my wife and I came up here to the Fort Collins area, and we met you for dinner in, I think it was November 2012, and you suggested that we come up, take a look at Estes Park, and so we have our permanent residence here in Estes Park with you to thank. So my wife wanted to make sure that I told you that we definitely appreciated that recommendation to visit Estes, because, man, I look outside the window every day. I go into my shop and see the, you know, 14,000 foot Long's Peak, and I'm grateful for that.
And elk everywhere, right?
Oh, man.
I love Estes Park. It's such a beautiful place and kind of a neat environment there. You know, it's different than a lot of places.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it has its quirks as far as trying to run a business in this town, and then also the restrictions of, you know, not being able to shoot your bow within the city limits because some idiot shot that, you know, Samson elk there a number of years, 20 or 30 years ago there. And so they passed legislation there that restricts that. So, I mean, there's, you know, some of that that's a bit of a downer, but, you know, everything else is all upside. And it's a beautiful spot. I love living at the elevation that we do here, you know, 7,500 feet, and then that kind of keeping me acclimated to that thinner air.
Right. Gets you ready for the high country.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, last year when I went up to the spot where we hunt mule deer, it's about 12,000 feet, and I'm used to going from sea level to 12,000. And I can tell you that living at 7,500 and then going up to 12,000 is a heck of a lot easier of a transition than going from sea level to 12.
You know, it's interesting. I found that as part of my move, that's actually been one of the few negatives, you know, living in Cheyenne at about 6,300 feet, coming here, living at 3,300 feet.
Oh, yeah.
And then going back into the high country, I noticed the difference.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let's talk a little bit about your move there. So you worked for the Air Force and got stationed or got an job assignment up there in Great Falls, Montana, which, I mean, normally for anybody that was going to get, get a new job assignment and get moved to Montana would not be a bad deal. But living in Wyoming, where you, I'm sure, kind of, how long did you live in Wyoming before you got moved there to Montana?
So I was actually born and raised in Wyoming.
Oh, okay.
I grew up, I was born in Sheridan, Wyoming, and then I joined the Air Force in 2002.
Okay.
I moved to Cheyenne in March of 2003. So I lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming for about 15 years before moving up here to Montana. So I spent my whole life there, and I know every bit of it, and it was a, it was an interesting transition. It was hard. I still get to go hunt with my family and my friends and in the places that I love. So that's nice. And then I got to add some as well and learn some new country, which has been a good thing as well.
Yeah. So did you get to hunt Montana last year? I don't remember when it was exactly that you moved, but I remember it was about the time I moved out here. Then you pulled up and moved north.
Right. Yeah. That was kind of a bummer in itself right there.
Yeah, no doubt.
I did get to hunt here last year. Work kind of got in my way. I didn't get to hunt a lot or near as much as I would like. I spent the majority of my time here hunting mule deer last year, and then I got to hunt elk very late in the season with a bow in the snow and the cold and the nasty. But I mean, I did get some hunting in here last year, and it was definitely different. It's a different style of hunting. The country's a lot different here than what I'm used to hunting. So it was a learning experience, but a real positive one.
All right. How's the mule deer hunting? I know, Montana has a pretty decent amount of mule deer as well as some really good, probably up and more, probably better quality whitetails really than mule deer anymore. The downside about Montana, and this kind of head scratcher for me, I think it's just so rooted in tradition that they have, that rifle season go over the rut there for mule deer, and consequently there's, the age class just isn't there in Montana like it could be if they stop that rifle season short of the rut.
Yeah, I think the genetic quality here is incredible. I've been very fortunate to measure some monster deer this year. And there are definitely some big deer here in the mule deer variety. But as you mentioned, the whitetail quality, especially to the north of Great Falls here, is truly, truly awesome. I've seen at least six Boone and Crockett whitetail this year and three Boone and
Wow.
Crockett mule deer. And in a handful of Boone and Crockett elk as well. The wildlife quality here is actually quite good, but the numbers aren't as good as they could be, as you mentioned. The seasons here are very interesting. They have, tags that cover huge portions of the state for archery hunters. Their 900 series tags include, a majority of their private land areas, or areas that are primarily private land. And then, they'll put in a couple of good areas in those, and they have those for deer, antelope, and elk. So it took a while to kind of learn and understand what their seasons are here. And you're right in that there are some really strange mule deer seasons, specifically, especially their plains mule deer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as a mule deer fanatic myself, I really appreciate how it's structured here in Colorado in that, that rifle hunting pressure. I mean, that four season rifle, they if they get the snows, they really, get some incredible opportunity at bucks early in the rut there. But a lot of times the weather doesn't cooperate, and so you don't get that migration and those deer coming in at lower elevation. Or if there's a bad snowstorm, maybe they'll just, migrate right through those areas, and particularly the deer in southern Colorado and right on down into New Mexico. So,
Right, exactly.
yeah, but Colorado's got some fantastic mule deer hunting. But let's maybe cover some of your hunting from Wyoming, and maybe starting out with antelope. I know that you've been really successful especially from a traditional bow hunting standpoint on antelope there in Wyoming.
Right, so antelope are a lot of fun. They're an incredible animal. I think I'm a very passionate elk hunter, and elk are by far my favorite, but I think antelope are one of the most beautiful creatures that exist in Wyoming. They're wildly resilient. They live in some brutal country, and they're a lot of fun to hunt. I've taken antelope both from a blind over a water hole and spot and stalk. The first antelope that I took spot and stalk, I actually swam down an irrigation ditch for about a mile and a half. And then shot him through a culvert, like I was in a blind, shot, through about a 4 foot culvert that they used to drop water into a downpipe for a side roll, but and a couple water ones as well. And they both have their advantages. There's something really special about a water hole where you get to sit and watch the world happen around you. You're just sitting there quiet, and the antelope are coming and drinking, and you're seeing them interact out amongst the hills, and that stuff's really neat. And I had a good friend that put me on some awesome antelope over at his ranch over in the Laramie area, and did a lot of neat things with him, and then did some spot and stalk. The main thing with antelope is the first thing you have to do is decide how you want to hunt them, and then decide where you want to hunt them. And you can't spot and stalk all of Wyoming. There are places in Wyoming where spot and stalk is next to impossible with a traditional bow. So choosing where you're going to hunt is more important than choosing, or choosing how you're going to hunt is more important than choosing, you know, what caliber of animal you want, because those aren't always going to line up.
Right.
Wyoming isn't New Mexico, first of all. You know, not every area in Wyoming holds 90-inch antelope. In fact, very few areas in Wyoming hold 90-inch antelope. It has the most antelope, but across the board, you know, an 86, 87-inch antelope in Wyoming it's huge. That's a really big goat. And they do kill a few 90-inch antelope every year. But so, you know, I always decided this year I want a spot and stalk. So then I would, you know, either look at maps or go for a drive and look for terrain, and then try to put in for an area that I thought I had a reasonable opportunity to spot and stalk one.
So I assume you're looking for kind of more broken country, you know, when you're interested in spot and stalk hunting them, right?
Absolutely. You're looking for breaks, and you're more just, it doesn't even have to be breaks. You just need some terrain. It just can't be big open country.
Mm-hmm.
Some of southern Wyoming has some pretty flat country, but it's got, you know, 4, 5, and 6 foot tall sagebrush in it. That terrain is actually relatively easy to spot and stalk in. You can get within 40 to 50 yards pretty easy, and then you just hang out and hope the antelope comes into you, you know, and it doesn't work every time, but they move around fairly. Antelope don't hang out anywhere very long.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they lay down, it's not for a significant amount of time. So it's, getting close and then letting them make the move is usually the most successful way that I've been.
Another thing too with antelope, and it's funny, I've heard a lot of people say that they're not all that great to eat, but man, the antelope that I've had have been some of the best eating meat that I've ever had.
Antelope are my favorite.
Yeah.
The people that think antelope aren't good to eat tend to take them and put them in the back of their truck and haul them around town on a 92 degree day and show all their friends. There is a trick to antelope. And it's, to me, it's a little bit about respecting the kill. And, you know, if you want to eat good meat, you take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first thing you do with an antelope is get the hide off as fast as you can. And once you get the hide off and get that meat cooling down, it's going to be the best meat there is.
Yeah, no, that's been my experience. Is you can't hardly beat it.
Oh, it's awesome.
So for antelope, for Wyoming, I've never really looked into it, and I don't know that I've been putting in for preference points for antelope. Maybe no, I think I do have. I gotta get up with the program here. I've got points for states all over the place, and forget, you know, how many I have, but. Yeah, I think
I have that problem as well.
Yeah. I think I've got probably more than enough. As I recall, a couple of years ago, I think I had 5. And so it's time for me to cash them in, because for an archery hunt, no, Wyoming, you're just getting a tag, right? And then you can bow hunt or rifle hunt off that tag. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, so Wyoming is kind of scattered in how tags are issued. For antelope, across the majority of the state, you put in for an antelope area, and then you can hunt all the seasons within that area.
Okay.
There are a couple of areas up in the Bighorn Basin that are archery only areas that do have a Type 9 license. They're archery only due to oil field activity or some type of agriculture activity where rifle hunting is not safe.
Gotcha.
So there is one of those. There's also some muzzleloader seasons that have a special tag. It's Wyoming calls it a Type 0. And there are a couple of those, but they're not the majority. I think there's, I'd have to look again. I think there's only one archery only area though, and maybe only 3 of those muzzleloader areas within the state. So
would that archery only area be is it like considerably better than some of the other areas in the state? Is it worth burning points for? I assume that that would be a more coveted draw.
It's an extremely coveted draw. It's an incredible area. It produces high quality bucks on a very regular basis. And I think in the Pope and Young convention a couple of years ago, the number one and number two goats were taken in that area exactly 1 year apart. To the day. It does produce very good antelope. The Bighorn Basin has quite a bit of BLM country in it, which makes it a coveted tag just for that reason. But that archery only area has some really good goats and it's fairly accessible. So those two things combined make it very popular.
So is that more of a spot and stalk or hunting water scenario there?
That area is actually really interesting in that you could do either. The western edge of that area has quite a bit of terrain. And then as you go to the east out into the basin a little farther, you get into some more breaky country and some of the oil field stuff, which has quite a few roads, but then, you know, you can get up high, do some glassing, and then work through some draws and things like that.
Oh, nice. So, what does, my question just slipped my mind there. I was already trying to think of the next one after the one I had in the bag. Then I forgot the one I had in the bag.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, no kidding. It's called getting old, man. It's, it ain't easy. That's for sure. So from a point standpoint, do you have any idea what that unit requires for points?
You know, I haven't looked in a while. I do know that Wyoming 3 years ago got a massive boost in antelope applications, which was really interesting. 3 years ago, 15,000 people applied for licenses in the state of Wyoming that had never applied for a Wyoming license before, between residents and non-residents. That was a significant increase in a single year. Those numbers have held pretty true since then. So that did kind of cause a bit of a point creep in the system for those behind that time frame. Right now, 3 points will draw most of the decent areas in Wyoming. Some of the really coveted areas, for example, the Red Desert, which is coveted again for its access, but also its quality of wildlife. Those areas are in that 5 and 6 point range for non-residents right now.
Okay. So conceivably I could be in good shape. What's the season dates for that antelope hunt or for the
nearly
hunts?
All of Wyoming, with the exception of one of the northeast corner right now, has an August 15th antelope opener for archery.
All right. So that gives you an opportunity to get out before most of the deer and elk seasons open up, which is kind of seems like it's somewhat typical for antelope that you can get an earlier start, which is nice.
Right. You know, we worked quite hard to get that August 15th opener. One of the reasons is you give youth an opportunity to archery hunt prior to starting school in most cases.
Oh,
and
sure.
That's kind of a neat deal. So we worked really hard on that to, you know, push for a statewide opener. There was some landowner resistance in the northeast corner that slowed that down up there. But for the most of the state, the kids can go out before they start school and hunt with mom and dad and have a lot of fun that way. And like you said, you get out before, you know, your elk and deer season's open. One of the real problems with Wyoming is there's no late archery seasons in Wyoming. So if you want to archery hunt in archery season and not compete with rifle hunters, for the most part, you have 30 days to do that. 1 September to 30 September. That 15th August opener allows you to get one of those tags and do a little hunting prior to that 1 September elk opener for those diehards like me.
Right. And then there are some units where they have an early high country rifle season that starts, what is that, the 15th of September, right?
So it depends on where you're at. There are a couple of areas in Wyoming that they're, you know, they're doing some management hunts. They're trying to cut some numbers down.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those hunts are fairly short-lived, as in you know, they're one or two seasons, you know, or years, hunting years, and then they go away. But on occasion, you'll see a one August season for a rifle on private land only type stuff. Then there's some backcountry areas, the thoroughfare country up by Cody and Metitzi up in there. That it's, I mean, it's way back there, but they do have a 15 September rifle opener. That one's stayed around for a long, long time, and it'll remain in place. But it's one of the only places in the U.S. that you get to hunt elk with a rifle during the rut.
Huh. Yeah, I hunted, I've only hunted Wyoming once, and that was for mule deer, and it was, geez, probably back in 2002, I want to say. So that, man, that's 16 years ago. I can't believe that. I should have
that was back when our mule deer herds were still doing good.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And I hunted over there on the western edge. Is I can't remember if it was G or F, what region it was. But man, I'll tell you what. So I hunted Colorado and then flew directly from Colorado into Jackson Hole there, and then my buddy picked me up at the airport there, and then we drove up into the mountains out of Afton, I think it was. And
Yeah,
so we got into, we saw, you know, a handful of bucks, but man, those things that were all grayed out there. So coming from Colorado, where a lot of them still had, you know, red in their capes and were really easy to pick up, and then going into that kind of more rocky alpine country there in Wyoming and having all the bucks gray, I had a heck of a time glassing deer up. They were kicking my butt. And it took me a while to make that, you know, adjustment in what I was looking for coming from looking at deer there in Colorado to looking at those bucks in Wyoming.
You know, it's funny how your eyes get accustomed to looking for something and it's hard to change that. I felt the same thing about mule deer. I went and hunted mule deer in Texas several years. I did some guiding down there and a little hunting myself, and their deer have a real, they're almost black in some cases. Huh. And they go stand in that mesquite and you can't even, I mean, they just vanish. They're straight up gone. They're like ghosts. We're coming from the real gray stuff. It's funny. Like I've learned to pick them out in Wyoming, and then I went to Texas and I couldn't hardly see the mule deer down there.
Uh-huh.
It
yeah.
took, you know, almost a full season to really get dialed in where I was picking them back up.
The first year that I really, well, it wasn't the first year I hunted mule deer, because I had shot one in the first mule deer in 1988, but I hunted them again in 1990. Actually, I didn't hunt them. I'd already tagged out on blacktail with both my California tags. And, so I just went along for the ride with a buddy of mine who had a, had an archery only tag, and we went into Eastern California and backpacked up into a wilderness area there. And I remember the first basin we popped our head into, and we're sitting there glassing it, and he's like, "Oh, there's one." And I was like, you know, I'm frantically looking around trying to glass it up. And after a couple minutes, and I still hadn't seen it, I'm like, "Well, where is it?" And, cause I mean, I couldn't find the thing. And he's like, right down below us, about 200 yards, right on that trail going through the middle of that opening. I mean, you can't get any more obvious than a deer standing on the trail in the middle of an opening. And I still couldn't find that thing. And, I mean, it was embarrassing. And finally, when I laid eyes on it, I realized, you know, I'd been used to looking at blacktail deer, and I was looking for something completely different than the coloration on that mule deer.
Right, right. I try to tell people one thing that is really tough is people tend to look for shapes as opposed to, or tend to look for color as opposed to shapes.
Right.
Got that backwards there.
Uh-huh.
Where I'm a big fan of having to look for actual specific shapes. I want to teach people to look for the shape of something as opposed to the color of something. And then you tend to pick them out of those holes like that a little bit easier when you're not looking. The same thing, you know, when you're cowboying or something, you're looking for cattle in the timber. You actually look for legs. You don't look for cows.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I find it a little bit the same.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense for sure. Cause I mean that you can get slight color, like, you know, we just said, slight color variations from region to region, or even, you know, you're used to looking at, you know, kind of that reddish color summer cape, you know, early season for mule deer. And a lot of times those older bucks will start to gray out earlier. And if you're too keyed in on that reddish color, you might miss, you know, the sighting of a big mature mule deer. And that's the last thing you want to be missing out on. So let's talk a little bit more maybe about Wyoming, you know, mule deer before we dive into the elk topic, because I know elk are your key there. But for a guy like myself, I know that you've been getting Wyoming mule deer have had a bad run of luck with winter kill the last few years. But in general terms, I mean, if you were sitting on some points, would you just pass and keep, you know, waiting for that mule deer herd to kind of rebound before you cashed them in there for Wyoming? Or do you think there's still good enough hunting to warrant cashing in 3 or 4 points?
You know, if you'd asked me that question 2 years ago, I'd have told you to cash them in and go west. 2 years ago, we had maybe one of the worst winter kills that I know of in quite a long time. We had a couple of real late storms, killed a lot of young deer and a lot of old deer. The middle-aged deer tend to seem to have made it through.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, our 2 and 3 year old deer, some of the 4 and 5 year old deer even made it through, but those old bucks and old does and all the fawns died that year. Most of the does dropped their fawns dead. We had almost no fawn crop. In contrast to that, last year was probably the best fawn crop I have ever seen in Wyoming. It was absolutely incredible. So I do think we're on the uptick. You know, the West has had the most hits, especially in the last probably 15 years. You know, I used to go out and pick up sheds all the time, and I'd pick up a backpack or a pickup load every weekend. And as shed hunting got more popular, that might be part of it. But, you know, I started finding less and less mature bucks, and I have seen an increase since about 2015 to 2016, I've seen a significant increase in the number of mature bucks that I was seeing, especially in the southern part of Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that is in contrast to the excellent work done by the University of Wyoming and the Game and Fish. They had essentially been, I don't want to talk bad about them, but they were not allocating tags based. They didn't understand some of the significant migration routes. You may know that they found the longest mammal migration route in the United States was actually a herd of mule deer that migrate from the southern border of Yellowstone National Park all the way to southern Wyoming, clear down to the inner to I-80 corridor, all the way down by Riverton, down in that country.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something like 150 miles or something?
In a straight line.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember watching a video on, I think it was maybe YouTube, showing that migration and weren't they completely unaware of how far those deer were migrating until they, radio collared one of them or some of them.
So it's really an interesting story. They didn't really have a clue. No one knew. So they were doing they do their counts in the winter when the deer are all gathered up, and they were issuing tags in southern Wyoming around that, you know, Riverton or Rock Springs area based on what they were seeing in the winter. And then they were just hammering the local herds. Rock Springs used to have some of the best mule deer country in Wyoming. And then, you know, it just kept dwindling and dwindling and dwindling, and nobody could understand why. They actually radio collared some deer down there, and then they never found them again. They didn't know where they went. Of course, you know, your radio collars don't work over 100+ miles.
Sure.
From, you know, if you go to where you think those deer are at. And it wasn't until a deer actually became, you know, got hit on the road and they found the radio collar unidentified it, where they started doing some flights on some radio collar deer and then expanding that study. And then along with that, the University of Wyoming jumped on board, as well as a significant number of NGOs or non-government organizations. So Wyoming Wildlife Federation, Bowhunters of Wyoming, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, a lot of, you know, hunter-founded, conservation-minded organizations jumped on board to support the study with funding and even, you know, bodies. Part of the study is looking at the winter kill and walking big portions of winter range, looking, you know, counting winter kills and things like that. And over the last several years, it's been a really eye-opening experience for a lot of people who they didn't understand the significance of that migration. You would never think to look, you know, for a mule deer that was in Yellowstone National Park in July, all the way down by, you know, Rock Springs, Wyoming, 150, 180 miles away.
Right.
In the winter.
Yeah, that's crazy. I wonder how much suitable habitat, winter range habitat, they're passing up along that migration there that they could, you know, utilize in instead or just out of, out of habit going all the way that far south.
No, it's really interesting. I actually just read the other day, one of the things they're learning is that they're actually following the vegetation, especially on their return north in the spring. So as vegetation ripens, they follow it to the north. And then when it becomes overripe, they tend to move up. And they eventually end up in the higher elevations of the Yellowstone ecosystem there. So some of that, I think, is probably driven by vegetation. I think some of that is driven by population, possibly. They've determined a couple of really key areas for that migration route that are, you know, where city centers and population is kind of pushing these deer out of their normal migration corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And they've sought to preserve some of those. The Game and Fish has done significant work in preserving some of those and making sure that we don't eliminate or cut off those migration corridors.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that, I mean, I guess it speaks to the low population density in Wyoming, but it's pretty remarkable that you can get a deer herd that migrates that far and doesn't run into major, you know, human obstacles, human created obstacles.
Right. Yeah, there's about three of them they've identified that are serious. But other than that, you know, of course, once you get out of the Star Valley, it's pretty much a clean shot all the way down.
Yeah.
Out through the desert, you know, they probably do pass some suitable habitat. And I find it interesting that most of the collared deer tend to stop at the interstate at the, you know, the I-80 corridor there. It would be interesting to see that if I-80 wasn't there, how far south would they have actually gone? Would they continue to move south? You know, there's some deer fence in that area with some overpass crossings and underpass crossings, things like that along that. And they're seeking to raise money to build more of those. But it would be interesting if that major human obstacle, obviously one of the most traveled interstate corridors there is actually stopping them from what their migration route may have been, you know, 40 or 50 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I've, you know, driving back and forth during my move out here from California to Colorado, there's, a couple of major, those deer overcrossings that they're putting in there in Nevada. And it's pretty remarkable to see how large of a construction project that is and how much money I can only imagine it's costing and the dedication to completing those projects. And I mean, it'd be really fascinating to put a trail camera on, you know, that on that overcrossing there to see how heavily they're getting used.
So they do that quite a bit. That's actually part of the study that they're doing. And there's actually a gentleman from University of Wyoming working on a PhD study right now to try to understand some of that and how do we one, reduce the cost. An underpass is about $500,000, $500,000. The overpasses are a shade over $1 million to $1.5 million, depending on the significance of it. Obviously over a divided highway, that cost would increase to about triple. They found that mule deer use the underpasses fairly well, that they're, you know, they've become used to them and they'll use them. And as long as they don't become flooded, that's an issue, a point of concern for mule deer. They don't like to be in the deep mud. and nothing does. I don't like to be in the deep mud, so I can understand why they wouldn't. So flooding is an issue for those. The overpasses are even more successful in that they actually see antelope using the overpasses, where antelope, they've seldom, if ever, catch one in an underpass or a culvert style transition zone. Antelope don't prefer that. They won't go through them hardly at all. But they found that, you know, the predators and things like that much prefer the overpasses, even though they're more expensive. They would be the preferred method going forward. So,
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, I mean, I'm sure that those, without knowing, I'm sure that those are largely hunter funded conservation projects. And it's nice to see, you know, that, that money, those resources getting put to, you know, to such important use.
A lot of it is hunter funded. In fact, Wyoming this year just pushed something through legislation that was essentially unprecedented in the state, where they're going to allow hunters to purchase it. They're calling it the mule deer license plate. And it's a big part of this mule deer migration. The Wyoming Wildlife Federation really kickstarted this and kept it moving. And with support of, you know, most of the organizations within Wyoming, including Bow Hunters of Wyoming. And now you're able to get this special license plate that looks pretty and different than everyone else. And you pay a little extra money, but that money goes to support those projects specifically,
nice.
Which is really neat. It gives you another opportunity to help support wildlife and show that hunters are the conservationists of the future and the past.
Yeah, we've got sportsman's plates here in Colorado, and when I traded my California plates in, I ponied up and got those as well. And like you said, it's a nice way to you know, not only support them, but then show the representation. And I don't know how many people, you know, make that connection that are non-hunters, but any way that we can show that we're supporting wildlife, I think is, you know, like you said, is really important there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Wyoming elk. And I mean, it's funny, you know, living or having driven back and forth so many times across Wyoming. Of course, I'm on Interstate 80 across southern Wyoming, but it looks like the bleakest possible elk state you could imagine when you're driving Interstate 80. But, you know, obviously knowing the history of Wyoming, I know there's a lot of elk there, but where do they reside if not, you know, crossing Interstate 80?
You know, I'm fairly sure the Interstate 80 was put there on purpose to keep people out of Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
So
does a good
pretty
job.
Sure that they made that so people would drive through Wyoming and think, "Man, I never want to come back."
Yeah, that's my like the worst part of the drive going from the coast, you know, across over here to Colorado. Not that you know, Nevada and the salt flats there are spectacular either, but it's rough.
You know, it's funny, if you actually, there's probably places you could go on I-80 and look just to the south around the Elk Mountain area. In the winter, those antelope or those elk actually winter right off the interstate there.
Huh.
Pretty good numbers of them even. So, I mean, there are places where you might be able to go and see those type of things. But as a general rule, I-80 is not where they're at. Oddly enough, just to the north of I-80, there's some of the best elk country in Wyoming. You just can't see it. You kind of got to squint and look to the north or squint and look to the south. One of the most popular elk places in the state of Wyoming is the Sierra Madres and the Snowy Range. They're incredible elk hunting. They don't produce a lot of ginormous bulls, but the elk hunting there is, especially in the Sierra Madres, is relatively huntable terrain for almost anybody. It's not real steep. It's not really huge country. You know, it's fairly accessible. So it's really popular with a lot of people. The other, you know, it's a big draw. It doesn't have any grizzly bears, which
mm-hmm.
being in Wyoming and Montana is something you have to think about a lot. You know, is, you know, are you willing to hunt with the bears because they're hunting too?
Right. So I take it it's largely the northwestern part of the state that you have to contend with or be worried about the grizzly bears?
In Wyoming, yes, especially, you know, the Cody Country, Sublette County, up into Bighorn County, up in that area is, or I'm sorry, not Bighorn County, Cody to the Montana border, mm-hmm. you know, all around that the whole Yellowstone ecosystem. And, you know, big breakthroughs have been happening in the grizzly bear world, which is a huge positive. We're about to have, I think here in August, we'll have a judgment on whether or not that's going to continue. But, you know, as grizzly bear population densities have increased significantly over the last several years, elk hunting has become also more of a challenge, hunting in those areas. So
just from a safety standpoint, you're meaning, right? Or from a calf,
precisely.
Calf predation too, or?
Calf predation is part of it. Although there's other predators that have a significant role in that. The wolf population has a fairly significant role in calf predation. More so percentage wise with moose, where almost no moose calves in the Yellowstone ecosystem live to adulthood right now. They do have a role in the elk. I do believe the elk are starting to learn to live with the wolves a little bit. There's some evidence of that. We probably won't see all that come to fruition, you know, in the next year, but over time, I think we'll continue to see evidence that the elk are improving their ability to live around the wolves. So that's a positive, but no, the safety aspect is really where it is. There's been some studies done that grizzly bears know to follow hunters. They've been known to follow gunshots. And recently there's been more and more conflict between archery hunters and grizzly bears. And, it is a concern. I don't say that to scare anybody away though. It's certainly huntable country. It's just not something that you go and do by yourself. It's not smart to go and do it by yourself, I don't think.
Yeah. And probably packing a sidearm and or bear spray is prudent.
Be prepared. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so is there pretty much everything for elk as a non-resident there in Wyoming is going to be a draw, right? There's not really over-the-counter opportunity.
No, there isn't any over-the-counter opportunities currently for elk in the state of Wyoming. They have the limited quota areas where it is a draw, and then it hasn't been all that long ago, they created a draw for Wyoming's general season as well, which allows you to hunt a lot of Wyoming, and the general areas in Wyoming are actually really good. My three best bulls have all been out of I think it's my four best bulls have all been out of general areas. General areas tend to have more people. They tend to, you got to hunt a little harder, but if you're willing to get off the road and, you know, go look for the elk and go hunt where the elk are at, some of Wyoming's general areas are extremely good.
And that of course is again, you can hunt with your bow and then go back with your rifle on those elk tags, right? Unless you're drawing a specific archery tag, or do those even exist?
So there are, and it depends on the area, on how you want to do that. So Wyoming regulations, and I've been told multiple times, they're nearly impossible to understand. And I felt that way about Montana when I got here. But so there's essentially there's a couple of ways to hunt Wyoming. And really there's three. So you can draw a type one license, which is your any elk license that allows you to hunt with archery or rifle in most areas. There are a few areas that are choose your weapon areas. You can draw a type one license and you can hunt in the rifle season, or you draw a type nine archery only license and you hunt in the archery season. Most of those areas exist in the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming, which is up between Sheridan and Grable, north central kind of area. And most of those areas exist there where they are choose your weapon. They are some of the most popular areas in the state, some of the hardest areas in the state to draw. And they are quality hunts, though, don't get me wrong. But then you can also put in for a Type 9 archery license. And you can hunt an archery only season. And then when that type 9 license is expired, your elk hunting is done. So you can kind of choose how you want to hunt. The big difference is in a lot of areas, the type 1 license only allows you half of the archery season and all of the rifle season, where the type 9 license allows you all of the archery season. In almost all cases, that's a full 30 days.
Hmm.
As opposed to 15 on the type 1. Now, and the choose your weapon areas are you know, you get a type 9 license or you get a type 1 license, and you choose, you know, you have to apply for whichever one is your preference.
All right. Yeah, I just, while we were talking here, I pulled up my preference points for Wyoming. I've got 9 elk points and 8 deer points. So I've got a pretty good collection. And I actually have 0 antelope. I thought I had been putting in for antelope, but I guess I was mistaken there.
Yeah, you know, on 9 elk points, you know, your options are pretty wide open. I think you could draw almost any of the really good areas in Wyoming for elk. So, you know, your options are pretty open at 9. 8 deer points, I'm not overly smart on the non-resident stuff. I'd have to take a look. I think, you know, with that many, your options are pretty, should be pretty open for opportunity on deer as well. You know, obviously our best mule deer tend to be on the west side. And like I said, they took a pretty good beating the last couple of years. So,
yeah, I'm not in any rush at this point. I mean, I got so many points, I'd probably just sit on them for a bit and let that deer herd rebound and pray for some mild winters, you know, consecutive mild winters to help facilitate that.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I think our fawn crop is looking really good this year. I traveled all the way across Montana, down through Wyoming, and into South Dakota this weekend, and saw a pretty good number of fawns. Antelope fawns are everywhere, of course. Looks like, you know, it's going to be good antelope hunting come about 4 or 5 years from now. But I saw a lot of mule deer fawns as well, and some whitetail fawns. All so, right. You know, it looks like our spring and winter was conducive to good fawn. Fawn production again this spring as it was last year. So I think there's good times ahead for sure.
Well, that's encouraging. So let's dive into your elk tactics. As you're not the typical, elk calling as far as being reliant on that for hanging tags on the elk that you hunt. Why don't you kind of get into what your preferred tactics are?
You know, it's interesting. I actually almost never call to an elk. And if I do, it's only to stop an elk. I've been known to call and stop an elk every once in a while if I feel like that's necessary. But I've never called an elk into me. In fact, it actually causes me anxiety to watch people call elk. I don't like it much. Elk are incredibly good at pinpointing your location. Incredibly good at it. You know, calling works as a team sometimes, and there are people who are just unbelievably successful in those methods. I'm not one of those people. I like to hunt elk. Some people call it shadowing. I call it just spending a lot of time with them. To me, it's more persistence than it is anything else. I tend to spend a lot of time in the glass, very similar to how, you know, you hunt mule deer. I hunt elk that way.
Hmm.
I really prefer more open country. My style of elk hunting really struggles in the heavy timber and the low country.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to be a little higher. I tend to be in some more open country, and I tend to spend a lot of time in the glass. And once I kind of understand where the elk are hanging out, and I also, on top of that, I try to hunt areas that aren't getting a ton of pressure. You know, I'm 5, 6, 8, 10 miles in off the road out of a backpack, because those elk are going to be more conducive to my style of hunting. I don't want to call them in. I'm not a big fan of calling them in. And they're not getting pushed 3, 4, and 5 canyons a day. So, you know, as opposed to the elk by the road that are always on the run. So I tend to hunt really deep, fairly high, spend a lot of time in the glass, and then I spend as much time learning the elk as I do learning the country. It's really important to me to know what the wind's going to do in any given place at any given time during the day. And I want to know when a cloud blows over this hill and the shadow comes in here, the wind's going to swirl this way or that way or come down this draw or that draw. And I tend to walk around and see those things, and I make notes all the time. Like, okay, I was here and the cloud covered up the sun. The wind switched immediately and blew this direction. And I'll make a note. I'll actually write that down and you know, I'll read that several times so that it be, you know, I commit that to memory. So next time I walk through there or if I'm in there with an elk, I want to know, okay, that shadow's coming up. I need to get across this draw and I need to be over there so that my wind goes past and things like that. An elk, you know, there's an old adage that an elk will see you twice and hear you three times and smell you once.
Right.
If they smell you, they're going to leave. That's all there is to it. And so the wind is extremely important. So a lot of my time is learning country. A lot of my time is glass. And then I just love to spend time with elk. So as soon as I find elk and I kind of feel like they're settled into an area, my favorite thing to do is get close and let the elk screw up. A big herd bull, most of the time you're not going to call in a big herd bull. And so you have to be flexible and you have to be diverse if you're going to try to kill big elk, especially with traditional equipment. And I've been very, very blessed to have stumbled into a few, and I screwed up just as many or 10 times more, honestly.
Sure, sure.
I mean, I've screwed up way more stocks than I've been successful on. But a couple of things with elk. If you're below an elk and you're trying to stalk him, you're probably toast. It's odds are it's not going to work. It's very, very hard to stalk an elk from downhill. He can move so much better than you can in that terrain. And to climb a hill at the same speed as an elk is doing anything, even grazing, is next to impossible. To be above an elk, though it's preferred from a visual perspective, is actually not that good from a wind perspective. Mountains tend to breathe. They breathe up and they breathe down. They don't breathe across the face very often. I really try extremely hard to stay on the exact same elevation as the bull that I'm pursuing. And that's it limits you somewhat in visibility, but it gives you huge advantages when it comes to the wind game. So I try very hard to stay on the same elevation. And I really sit back and I let the elk talk. I love listening to elk talk. And when I talk back to them, I tend to screw that up. So I don't talk back to them. I let them do their thing and they tell me where they're at. And then I come to them. So that's my favorite part.
What's your philosophy on camouflage, particularly like face or hands or what have you?
I don't worry so much about my face or hands. My hands, especially. I will put some, charcoal. Actually, I carry a cork in my backpack and a lighter, and I'll burn the cork and put some charcoal on and kind of break up my face a little bit if I feel like the sun's really beating down on me. Honestly, it's not that big a deal for elk. It's elk aren't whitetail. They're not antelope. They tend to rely so much on their nose that some of the other things you can get away with. I tell people all the time, you don't have to be quiet if you're around an elk. You just have to be around elk. You know, if you're noisy and there's a single elk out there, he's going to leave. That's all there is to it. But if you're in a herd of elk, you can break sticks and be loud and even have some movement, and you can get away with a lot as long as you're paying attention to when you do it. So camouflage to me, I don't cover my hands ever. I seldom ever wear gloves unless I have to, cause it's too cold. I don't like to shoot my bow with gloves. I don't feel like I shoot good with gloves. So therefore I just don't wear them. And camouflage is, I'm a big proponent of functionality as opposed to color. I do think you can be too dark as opposed to being too light. I'd rather be too light than too dark at any time.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's really, I think that's a fundamental point of camouflage if you're too dark, you look like a bear from far away. That's all there is to it.
Right.
They're going to see you. You know, there's some old camouflage patterns that I would never wear. I also tend to be one of those brand destroyers that some people call me. I've wrote some articles and I get a hard time for it every single time, but I also tend to wear a different pattern, top and bottom.
It's funny. And I mean, I read it to elaborate on that a little bit. I read an article a number of years ago, and I mean, this is a long time ago, but probably 15 years ago. And it was, even then I was kind of shaking my head at it. They were talking about, you know, you should never mix your camouflage patterns. And it's like, well, I mean, it does not make any sense from a logical standpoint. If anything, it would make more sense to mix them, because that's essentially what you're trying to do, is break up your outline and break up, you know, that's what camouflage is a
right.
mixture of patterns and colors. And if you have, you know, your top in one and your bottom in another, then that's only going more towards breaking up that outline. So, yeah, you know, I agree 100% on that. It's a good idea to do that.
Yeah, I do it all the time. If you think about a rock that's, you know, a boulder that's laying on the ground, it changes at the ground, right? Mm-hmm. Think about a tree that's coming out of the ground. It changes at the ground. So if I'm sitting down on the ground, I need to change at some point, or I look like a person still.
Right. I mean, you have the trunk of the tree, and then you have where it morphs into the branches, and you know, there's a dramatic difference there between the trunk and the branches.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't, you know, and if I get up in the morning and I put on the same color shirt as I do pants, I don't stress about it.
Sure.
But oftentimes you'll see in most of my pictures or something like that, that I'm wearing different patterns, top and bottom. And that's intentional to some point. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about my patterns, as long as I don't purchase anything that's dark. I purchase stuff that's warm, durable, and waterproof for the most part.
Right. Yeah. And I'm with you there. I'm glad to see that, you know, more and more of these Western patterns are going lighter in color, and they do, you know, a great job on breaking it up. But, the patterns that were available, you know, 15 years ago or 10 years ago, even, for the most part, were kind of catered towards that Eastern audience.
Absolutely. You know, one of the first Western patterns was the tree bark camo, you know, which
yep.
is probably more like, it's less like camo and more like a business suit in a lot of cases.
Sure.
For many farther than about 10 feet away.
Right.
You know, and I also, I probably don't, I don't prefer any type of camo that looks like an artist picture. You know, I don't want leaves and sticks and branches. Most of my camo tends to be artificial shapes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a couple of companies that make some really neat stuff that it works extremely well. And I try to take it from wildlife. We were talking about mule deer a moment ago. They don't wear camo, and they're extremely hard to see sometimes.
Yeah.
And they can be out in the middle of a green thing and they just lay down and they're gone. You know, they don't wear camo. I find antelope absolutely amazing in that they're basically big blotchy blocks. You know, they've got a white spot and a brown spot that goes over it and down their leg. And an antelope out in the right country, he just stops and he's really hard to see if he's standing still. And that's where you have to stop and pick something out that isn't part of the background. You know, you look for an ear or a horn or a leg, and, you know, something straight, things like that. And, you know, you take a lot of your cues from that kind of stuff. And I don't tend to worry so much about my camo. I shot my first bull was a really nice bull with a traditional bow. I shot wearing a pair of black Carhartts.
Hmm.
And an ASAT shirt, I think, is what I was wearing, along with a Cabela's crushable wool cap, hat that I still wear that same hat to this day. It got a big notch cut out of the brim for my bowstring.
All right.
And, you know, I just, you know, I found this bull and he was feeding up towards me, and I went and sat down inside of a greasewood bush, and he came right up to, you know, he came up and grazed within, you know, about 18 yards. And, you know, I made my shot, and you know, I was wearing black pants, and people think I'm crazy, but I was hunting in some really stickery country. There's a lot of hawthorn where I was hunting then, and that hawthorn's bad stuff. So.
Yeah, light you up there, turn you into a pincushion.
Oh, it's bad.
What? So, kind of getting back to your elk tactics, do you prefer to watch them until they bed and then try and move in on them in their bedding area, or pick them up in the morning and evening when they're feeding, and then try to get in close and maybe get ahead of them as they're moving towards a bedding area? Or is it what's your preferred tactics there?
A little bit of everything. I will tell you, I find that being close to the elk and noticing opportunity is the most important part. It doesn't necessarily matter what the elk are doing. Just stay with them and seize the opportunity when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
On that same point, you have to know when something is not an opportunity, and you have to know when to stay away. I think knowing when to stay away is more important than knowing when to go in. If you really want to hunt a bull that you've picked out, and this is a great bull and I need to get this bull, when you run him off, he's going to be hard to find again. And, you know, especially most of Wyoming. I grew up hunting in the Bighorns, of course, growing up in Sheridan. When you run an elk off there, he may run from the high country all the way to the hay fields, and you'll never have an opportunity of that bull again. So knowing when to stay out is just as important or more important than knowing when to go in. So I tend to get close as I can possibly be to an elk herd, and just stay with them until I see that opportunity. That opportunity can take on any face, and you have to know what it is. For me, opportunity a lot of times is when they're moving. So kind of like you said, from feeding to bedding or water, things like that. Bulls, big herd bulls, will oftentimes want to be in the middle of their herd on the uphill side. And so when I see a herd moving, I try to position myself on the uphill side, but in a place where I'm not going to be seen until elk are significantly past me, and try to be in a position that bull is, he's watching his herd go under him. And with with very few exceptions, when elk bed down, they tend to bed down with cows around them. They want to lay in the middle. They want that protection. And so when they're moving is one of the better times to find a bull away from his cows. I guess I should say that it's nearly impossible to kill a good bull elk with cows. If he's in his cows, that's a lot of noses. That's a lot of eyes. That's a lot of ears to play with. And so I like to catch them when they're away. Moving is one of those times. However, my favorite time to hunt elk, and people, you know, my dad has told me I'm crazy for years. There are a lot of times when I'll sleep in. If I know where the elk are and I know that they're in this area, I'll leave camp at 9 in the morning, 10 in the morning. I'll let everybody else go up there and run around and do whatever they want to do. And then I'll go in to where those elk are. And I'll sit, you know, quite a ways away, half a mile away from where I'm pretty sure they're bedded. And a lot of times I can find them. I can sort through the trees and pick out a cow. If I see a cow, I'm going to stay right there. That bull's with them, especially in that mid to late September time frame. And I'll sit there and I'll wait and wait and wait. And about 12 o'clock, you know, between 11 and 2, the cows are going to start getting up. They get restless. They need to stretch their legs. They need to get a drink of water. They want a bite to eat. All those different things. I have been more successful harvesting elk with my recurve at 2 o'clock in the afternoon than any other time of the day. And start getting up. they'll all get up with very few exceptions. Almost every cow in the herd will get up. And I don't care if there's 10, 5, or 80 cows. They're going to get up midday, and they're going to start moving around. That bull is tired. He's been trying to gather cows all night long, and he is wore out. He is almost always the last one to get up out of the herd. The satellite bulls are looking for opportunities. They're up with the cows. They're down the hill. And he will tell you when he's alone. This is the coolest part about hunting elk with a bow, is they actually tell you when it's time to go shoot them. And you'll hear him. He'll start to bugle, and his first bugle will be a question. And you can hear it. It sounds like a question. It's just a long, clean bugle. And he's like, where are my girlfriends? Where's my curd? And then that bugle is going to become more frequent and more intense. And when you hear that intensity increase, it is time to move. And I tend to drop from my perch, and I usually stay fairly high above them. In the daytime, when the sun is up, the wind usually blows up the mountain. So I tend to stay off to one side, but above them. And as soon as I hear that intensity change in his voice, I move, and I move very fast. I want to know where the cows are, and if I can't find them, I will slow down. But if I know where they're at already, I will barrel in. And I mean, it's a straight up, sometimes it's a run. Other times it's a fast walk, but I'm moving towards that bugle. And when I think I'm, you know, with 60, 70 yards, that's when I start my stalk and I start moving in. Remember, he's looking for cows. He's listening for sound. He's listening for footsteps. Sometimes just me moving in is enough to get him to come right to me. And multiple times this has worked. When I say multiple, I mean, it works a lot of the time. I don't always get a shot, and I don't always make the shot. I've been known to miss my fair share of times as well. But it's a very successful method of getting in on a herd bull. It just takes a lot of time. When everyone else is at camp drinking a beer or hanging out, you've got to be out there and ready. A lot of people don't think about hunting elk at 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But to me, for big bulls, it has been the most successful time of the day for me to get within shot distance, which for me is 35 yards and under.
It seems like a lot of callers are kind of adapting to that midday strategy now too, where they'll, they know the elk are stationary, and if they've, you know, pinpointed where they're at, they'll try to move in close and challenge them. So similar kind of, different tactics entirely. You're going in silent, but if you were to narrow down a 10-day period in September to go to hunt them, to employ these tactics, what would that 10-day stretch be?
Oh, you're going to think I'm crazy. So almost everyone that hunts elk looks at the moon, right? The moon's really important. It does make a difference on wildlife movement. All of my big bulls have been killed within 2 days of the full moon.
Wow.
And there's a couple reasons for that. It works much better when the full moon is around the mid-month. So from the 10th to the, you know, the 18th, if the full moon falls within that time frame, it works extremely good. I believe there's a couple reasons for that. One, when the full moon is up, the elk are out all night. That gives that herd bull an opportunity to build his herd. And if you hunt elk a lot and you watch elk a lot, you'll notice that herds grow around the full moon. As it starts to get brighter at night, he spends more time gathering cows and building his herd. What that does is makes them go to bed earlier, which forces that midday strategy for them to get up and move around. He's more tired than his cows, and he's going to stay bedded longer than his cows, with so few exceptions. It's one of the few things about elk that you can almost count on. So the full moon for me is a really good time to hunt elk in my tactics. I think these tactics work really good around the full moon. So I tend to go hunting. I tend to take my time 3 days before the full moon, and I find that my best days of hunting are the 2 days after the full moon. So I watch the full moon. If that doesn't work, if the full moon is very early in the month, then I tend to go, I leave the 10th of the month and I hunt through about the 25th.
Yeah,
and I find the really good days are the 10th, 12th, 13th. I find those to be really good days. There's a couple reasons. One, they don't have big herds. The guys that love the end of the month, they're hunting really big herds, 60, 70 elk. You know, that's really hard hunting in a lot of cases. There's a lot of satellite bulls, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with satellite bulls. In fact, I have a herd bull that I shot that when I was done, I really wished I would have shot a satellite bull because he was significantly bigger.
Huh.
As you progress through the rut and into that last week of September and the first week of October, you're looking at really big herds. And also, once a herd is established, every tactic becomes much more difficult. I don't care if you're calling or shadowing or spot and stalk, whatever it is. It gets tougher as that month goes on.
Huh. Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, that 10th to the 20th has got a new moon in that stretch there this year.
Right. I think it does this year. Yeah. I think it does.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
And so the new moon is interesting in that it really creates a lull in the middle of the day where nothing happens. And it's not my favorite time to hunt, because you don't have the reliability of that midday lull for those cows to start moving. And that's where, when I'm hunting the new moon, I tend to concentrate much more on the travel corridors than the bedding areas.
Hmm. So commuting time back and forth to their feeding area there.
Absolutely.
What about wallows? Do you do anything with wallows, or are they just kind of a passing interest?
I have tried to hunt wallows. The areas that I prefer to hunt, you know, my favorite, you know, my honey holes, there's so much water in them that they could wallow anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I have shot one elk out of a wallow. I actually watched a bull midday, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I watched a bull get out of a bedding area and go down, and he went around his herd to the north. I went around his herd to the south and met him at the wallow. I stalked into the wallow while he was in there. It worked out really good, but I wasn't hunting the wallow. I think it's important to know where they're at and know which ones are being used. That tells me where the elk are. I personally don't spend a lot of time hunting a specific wallow because there's just so many of them where I'm at. I do take note of every one of them that I see, but there's so many. And by so many, I mean there's 30, 40, 50 in any given canyon where I hunt. Mm-hmm. So they can wallow in so many places. There's little springs running out of the walls of the canyon. And there's these big swampy areas in the bottom, and they can wallow all over. One of the most popular wallows in my favorite area is actually in the middle of a huge flat, where from the nearest tree is like 150 yards out to it.
Holy cow.
And it's funny that the elk like to go out there and wallow, but they love the thing. it's a really popular wallow, but it's next to impossible to hunt. So,
yeah, no, that's it's kind of surprising that, you know, during daylight hours that they'd or, you know, midday, whatever. I'm assuming that it's, you know, middle of the day they're out there, that they would put themselves that far out in the open.
Right. And again, it's probably not your herd bulls using that. I don't know that I've ever seen a really giant elk in that, but it's part of a travel corridor. It's actually, it's a place where they transition between kind of their feeding area. And they kind of go over this canyon and down through this big bottom where this wallow's at, and then up into a sunny hillside to bed for the day late in the September. So I think it's just kind of a happenstance. And then you'll see elk all through the day. It's not uncommon to see a little raghorn or a spike just run out of the trees out into that wallow and splash around for a few minutes and just haul butt back up into the trees. It's kind of funny, and it's really entertaining, actually.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? The antics of younger animals. I've seen, you know, mule deer act like they were on drugs, you know, chasing each other around, like playing the game of tag. And I've seen the same thing with blacktails, too. And elk can get, you know, particularly when you're looking at them in the rut, and they get the drunk craze going, and the antics can be rather, like you said, rather amusing.
Oh man, elk gate, crazy. You know, I love it. Every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, but every once in a while, you'll get in to a herd of elk, and a friend of mine called it an elk frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good way to explain it, where things are just going nuts. The cows are talking all over the place, and there's bulls running each other all over. And it's funny, if you get into one of those situations, it's amazing what you can get away with. One morning I got into camp. I couldn't get off work when I wanted to, and I got into camp a few days late, and I didn't get there till about 9:30, 10 in the morning, and it was getting ready to storm. A friend of mine had a moose tag, and I really, this gentleman has been a mentor of mine since I was just a little kid, and I really wanted to be with him on his moose hunt. It was really important to me. But he's also the kind of person that if I had an elk tag in my pocket, he was going to be extremely uncomfortable if I was moose hunting with him. So I met him on the road on the way into camp. It was about 9:30 in the morning. I said, you know what? I'm just going to go up there. I'm going to shoot the first elk I see so I can go moose hunting with you. He laughed. Ha ha. Yeah, right. Well, so I got into camp, got there about 9:45, 10 in the morning. And I just, you know, threw on some camo and cruised up the road and, or up the trail, I mean. And about 3-4 miles up the trail, I just hear these elk just going nuts. I can hear bulls bugling across the canyon and back and forth, and the cows are talking. And so I backed way up, and I went up, and the storm rolled in. And it was like a straight up blizzard and lightning, and those snow lightning is crazy stuff. It's just really weird to see. But so I went all over through that stuff and got where I thought I was in a good position, and the bull was on the far side. So I moved down and far around and came back up the other side to get the wind right. And finally got where I could see this bull. He was bedded down in this blizzard and just screaming his head off. He never quit. And I found him, and I spent about 15 to 20 minutes looking for every cow I could find. And again, I'm looking for shapes. I was looking for noses and eyes and tails and legs and ears and picking them out through the rocks and the trees. And I thought I decided I could go from here, you know, down through this little channel, and I thought I could avoid all the cows visually. But I knew when I got to where I could shoot that there was going to be some cows that might be able to smell me. But everything is talking. Everything. I mean, there was a cow, I'll bet she didn't go 30 seconds without making a sound.
Wow.
She just continually just chirping and chirping and mew and mew and mew and mew and mew. And it covered up all my sound. And I could make any sound I wanted because there was about 65 head of elk in this area just talking constantly. And I swung around and I picked my path, and I literally just crawled as fast as I could down this little spot. And I got to where I thought I could shoot this bull, and he stood up and moved forward right into my shooting lane. I could have put him in a better place. I made probably the worst shot I've ever made on an elk, but my approach was good. My shooting was really bad. He actually winded me just as I shot. At full draw, I felt the wind on the back of my neck. And it was one of those deals where everything's automatic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he spun, but I had already released, I think, and I hit him right about as far away from where you're supposed to hit him as I could possibly hit. Turned out to be, a very lethal shot. Not one I would recommend to anybody in a bow hunter education class, but it worked extremely well, and I followed up. I did all the things right, but ended up that I got into camp at 10 o'clock, and at 1:30, I had shot one of the best bulls of my life. So,
holy cow.
it was a really neat adventure. And I got to go and video a hunt for one of the people who has been responsible for teaching me more about elk than anyone else I can imagine. So it was really, really neat to, and those are his tactics. Some of those are his tactics, and he taught me some of those things and what to look for. And he's the guy that taught me to look for shapes as opposed to look for elk.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look for elk. You look for ears and eyes and noses and tails and back lines. It's amazing how many times, if you just look for the line of their back, that you'll find them, as opposed to looking for an elk.
Right.
Looking for an elk is really hard in the trees.
Yeah, those horizontal lines are really good cues to be searching for.
Absolutely, yeah. And so it was a really cool adventure and a lot of fun. I shot a great bull. That bull ended up, you know, he's one of the best that I'll probably ever get in my life. So
what are you wearing for footwear? What's your preference when you're going out there?
If it's dry, I'm wearing Salomon Speedcross 3s. It's just a, you know, it's a running shoe. Mm-hmm. It's a trail type running shoe, but they're incredibly, incredibly grippy. You can go through anything with them. They are a little loud, so you have to be mindful of that and take them off if it's appropriate to take them off. I don't do that a lot, but I do from time to time. I will take my shoes off and make an approach if I need to be real quiet or stealthy, you know. But if it's wet weather, I will wear Kenitrex or Zamberlin boots, depending on, you know, the situation. If it's snow, I tend to wear tall Zamberlins. If it's just kind of rainy or wet, I wear a little bit shorter Kenitrex.
Mm-hmm. All right. And when you moved up there to Wyoming, you mentioned you had to do some of a learning curve and adjustment. Was that in elk habits, or was that hunting tactics to new terrain, or what were your challenges that you had to overcome there?
First of all, the licensing system here in Montana is crazy compared to Wyoming. So it's actually, truth is, it's really Wyoming that's crazy. Most other states are somewhat similar to what Montana does. In Montana, you buy a license and then you apply to hunt, you know, you get an additional tag to hunt certain areas or a permit to hunt a certain area. So you buy a general tag and then you get a permit that's an addition to that license. In Wyoming, you apply for a specific area. So I had to learn that stuff. And it was a bit of a challenge to figure some of that out. The other thing about Montana is the most of Montana is extremely steep country, and big, big country. So the way that elk move through this bigger country is a lot different than the way they move through most of the country I hunted in Wyoming. Elk tend to be really free movers where I used to hunt in Wyoming, both in northern and southern Wyoming. There is some big country when you go out towards the Tetons and the Star Valley area or there around Cody, but none of it's really impassable to elk for significant distances. There are places in Montana where there's an entire canyon that's cliff walls on either side, and it's bighorn sheep and mountain goat country, and that's it. The elk don't even want to go there. So a big part of it was just learning how elk move in this country so that I knew where to be and when. Shadowing doesn't work, and just being with elk doesn't work if you don't know where they're going and where they're going to be. So I had to change my tactics, and I had to learn where elk were going to be. My first year hunting here was not as successful as I had hoped because I felt like I was always behind. I was trying to catch up all the time, where when you know an area well enough and you've learned an area well enough, you can always be ahead. It's important to be ahead because I don't care how good a shape you're in, an elk is going to outwalk you running every time. So there's some real importance in scouting. I may have learned some lessons last year that I did not scout as well as I probably should have to understand the elk movement in a certain area. I'm not a big fan of looking for elk as much as I am at looking at certain areas. I probably should have spent more time with elk to learn how they move, but there's a pretty big difference in where elk live a lot of times in July versus where they live in September.
Right.
So
you almost have to do your scouting either during the season or like that week, you know, immediately prior to it. And even then, you know, from that first week of the season to the last week of the season, as you know, the bulls are starting to, you know, particularly those herd bulls, the more older mature bulls are coming out of the higher elevations and maybe dropping down into the timber. It can be challenging scouting for elk.
Absolutely. And And I don't, that's why I don't put a lot of stock in where I see elk or where people tell me they've seen elk, you know, on 4th of July weekend when everybody goes camping and barbecuing. I tend not to even really take that into account when it's time for me to go hunting. I tend to look for terrain that I think is huntable, first of all, and then I look for elk in there. I'm also not a person, I don't spend 3, 4, and 5 days in an area if I don't see elk. If I'm not in elk, I'm moving, and I'm moving, and I'm moving. When I hunt solo, I hunt with my camp on my back all the time, and I sleep when it's time to sleep, and I move when it's time to move. And if I'm not in the elk, I'm looking for them. I constantly move. I've had people tell me, I hunted up in that canyon for 15 days and never saw an elk. And I just can't help but think, why did you stay in there 15 days?
Right, right.
That doesn't make any sense to me. You wouldn't do that hunting mule deer, right? You wouldn't go into a canyon and if there's no deer in there, you're going to go to the next canyon and look for deer.
For sure.
And the same thing applies to elk. And, you know, and I think it is, there are some similarities in hunting mule deer and elk, in that, especially high country mule deer and elk, in that if they're in a place and they're comfortable, they'll stay there a very long time. But as soon as they're moved, they're very hard to find again.
Right.
You know, I've found big mule deer in upper, alpine basins. I've found mule deer on 4th of July weekend, and I'll go back if there's not a lot of snow in October and he's still there within 100 yards. It's like they never leave sometimes. And I'll find the same thing with elk. You know, there's one place I really love to hunt, and it's an incredible area. I can't hardly draw it. I haven't drawn it in 5 years, which kind of makes me sad. But it's a kind of a network of canyons, and there's always elk in there, but knowing which one they're in is a bit of a challenge from time to time. But I don't go scout there ever. I know the country. I study maps all the time. Even though I've been in it a lot, I still study maps. And even when I don't draw it, I'm looking at maps. I'm thinking, man, I bet there's elk right here right now, you know, and I look at all those things. The things I try to remember and take into note. And then I also go and study areas where, okay, I have a tag for this area. I'm going to go here. I drew a really neat tag from Montana this year. I'm super excited about. And a friend of mine from Wyoming and myself, we're going to hunt an area in Montana that should be a lot of fun. And it's a really different area from Montana. It's not that big, steep country. It's a little bit more, I don't want to call it simple terrain, but it's a lot more open terrain. You know, it's an open timber kind of construct. It's not the real dark timber that you see in western Montana. So I'm excited to give it a try. It'll be a little bit different area for me from where I hunted last year, but I'm really happy about it and excited to have the tag. So
nice.
I'm really looking forward to September this year.
So tell me from a gear standpoint, you know, when you're talking about carrying your camp on your back, what are you packing as far as a backpack, sleeping bag, pad, tent or shelter, and maybe a stove? What are the specific product or brands that you're carrying?
So I'm carrying a Tenzing CF15 pack, probably the most comfortable pack I've ever owned. I love the thing. I carry a Kuyu down 15 degree sleeping bag most of archery season. It's way warmer than I need for the majority of archery season. But the weight versus the ability of the bag is it's incredible. It's hard to beat. I carry an MSR stove, a little WinPro stove that has just been with me for a long, long time. I love the thing. Carry a water filter, MSR water filter, all the time. The last place I want to be sick is 10 miles back in the wilderness with Giardia or something like that.
Which filter?
All my water.
Which filter are you using? Do you remember the model?
You're going to make me look it up. I had it a long time. I actually bought it for my dad's sheep hunt years ago. I have one of those Moichs, the MSR Moichs pens.
Uh-huh.
And I actually, I will use that quite a lot as well. But if I need large amounts of water for cooking, I use a water filter.
So you're probably using
I'm gonna look it up for you real quick.
A Mini Works.
It's a little pump filter, yeah. It's got like a little
ball valve
don't even
in
make
there.
It anymore. I'm probably looking for something that doesn't even exist. Mine is really similar to what they make now. It's not this exact thing, but it's like the Hyperflow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So does
MSR Hyperflow.
It uses the straw technology versus a ceramic or paper filter.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and then mine has a little pump on the side, and you pump it into. It's got a tube that goes to a cap, and then into a 4-liter dromedary bag.
Mm-hmm.
And so that bag doubles as one water storage for me for cooking or things like that. But it also I use it as a Camelback type, a water source for whatever.
Yeah, water bladder. Yep.
Exactly, bladder. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
And then
I carry I have a North Face, or not a North Face, Therm-a-Rest, just a light Therm-a-Rest pad that I carry all the time.
Inflatable or a foam?
It's an inflatable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Inflatable. I carry a North Face tent. If my weather's forecasted to be bad, and it kind of depends on how long my trip is. Some of my backcountry trips for elk hunting are 10 days and I'm by myself, or, 10 or 12 days and I might have a friend with me, it just depends on what's going on. I'll go either way. So when it's time to hunt elk, I'm going to go hunt elk. But a lot of times I carry just the rain fly, only the rain fly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I carry quite a bit of, freeze dried food. I'm not as talented as you. I can't make my own. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those backpacker pantry kind of guys.
Mm-hmm.
I do take all those foods out of the packages, though, and I put them in Ziploc bags. You can cut a lot of weight by getting rid of those big metal packages.
Right.
And then I mix, I heat my water in a little pan, and then I just mix the food in the pan and take a little water to clean it out. It's not a big deal. So I do that. I carry about 6 pairs of socks. I wash them and I'll tie them to my pack and I dry them all the time. It's really my feet sweat really bad. It's really important for me to have fresh, clean socks, and I do that a lot. Mm-hmm. I'll actually stop hunting elk to wash socks and make sure that they're good to go for when I need them.
Right.
So I look kind of like a silly dude with socks hanging off my pack all over the place sometimes. But
it's like a ghillie suit.
Right? Yeah, it works good. So
what about your breakfast and lunch meals? What do you do for that?
So I'm not a big breakfast fan. I don't tend to eat a lot of breakfast. But I backpacker pantry meals are my favorite. I usually eat lunch unless I'm really in the elk. And then I always eat dinner after dark when I'm hunting. So as soon as it gets dark, I tend to, find some water, get to my place where I think I can spend the night. One important thing about where I sleep, I will not sleep in the elk. If I have to walk 2-3 miles in the dark to get away from where the elk are that I'm hunting, I will do it. Elk love to move in the night. And if they run by your camp in the night, they're going to be gone in the morning. So I tend to get away from the elk that I'm hunting and camp somewhere, even if it means a long walk in the morning. I get away from them before I set up for the night. Unless I'm going to hunt them all night. Now, I don't mean that I'm hunting elk at night, but there are times when I'll stay with elk all night. If I think they're moving or a bull's really super active at dark, I will stay with him until he's no longer active so that I know where he's going to be in the morning. That's a weird thing that I have. It's been successful for me one time, and I think I have to keep doing it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It does help me find elk in the morning, but I did stay with an elk all night long one time, and I was able to harvest that elk at daylight in the morning. It was a really long night and a really long day packing him out the next day, but it was totally worth it.
Yeah, I guess. It's like up for 36 hours there, huh?
Right. So that one was I started hunting that elk. I was 17, I think it was 17. And it was an elk I'd been hunting for several years. I ended up never being able to harvest this this elk with a bow at that time, and I ended up harvesting him with a rifle. So kind of a different story. It was the last bull elk that I shot with a rifle. Actually, I haven't shot an elk with a rifle since I was 17. Or a bull elk. I have shot a couple of cows.
Yeah,
for clarity's sake. But it was kind of a weird deal. But I followed him all night, full moon, kind of like I was saying before. But strange deal. But yeah, so I love the backpacker pantry food. They're actually really good food, especially when you're elk hunting. Maybe things just taste better then. I don't know, but their beef stroganoff and their spaghetti are my favorite, and I tend to just fill my pack with those two.
Yeah, almost.
Do not ever take freeze-dried ice cream anywhere in the woods with you, because there's no amount of water that can recover you from eating one of those things. So
like eating a dry sponge, huh?
It is amazing. You're thirsty for like 3 days after you eat one of those things. Sounds right. Good. It is not.
Yeah. I'm an ice cream fan and I've only eaten one of them. You know, I could survive on ice cream alone, I think, but it's got to be cold and frozen and creamy and all that, and the freeze dried right? ice cream bars just don't cut it for me either. So yeah,
I ate one of those one time, and seriously, I've never been so thirsty in my entire life. I thought I was like dying of dehydration. I could not drink enough water.
Well, that's hilarious.
It was the weirdest thing. Actually, that same hunt when I ate that ice cream bar, I was drinking water in the middle of the night, and I was in the snowy range. And I had found a bunch of elk and backed way off and was just kind of laying out in the trees. I mean, I wasn't really camped by any water supply. I'd actually got quite a bit of water with me because I didn't know what was up there. And I woke up in the middle of the night and was getting a drink of water from eating my ice cream bar. And there's a black bear walked right up to me, looked right in my face, like from a couple inches away. I kind of turned my flashlight on and I shined it at him, and I didn't have a sidearm. I wasn't hunting grizzly country, you know. Actually, at that time in Wyoming, it wasn't legal to carry a sidearm during archery season. That has since changed. But my bow was hanging on a tree behind me, and this black bear is just staring me right in the face. And I was like, "Hey, bear, what are you doing?" His eyes got huge, and he took off running. And I was just thankful that he limped the other way so that I didn't get chewed on like you did.
Right, right. I don't think I'd have let him get as close as you did.
I didn't even honest truth is, I had no idea he was there. I told you, I just carry a rain fly for the most part.
Uh-huh.
And I lay on the rain fly, and then I just throw it over me so that the opening is on the downhill side. And it can rain pretty hard, and you can stay fairly comfortable in a good north face rain fly.
Sure.
And so that's all I had. And, you know, I usually keep my water, I keep water close by underneath that. And my backpack's usually covered up underneath the rain fly as well. And I had just reached into the side of my pack and grabbed my water, and I could hear something walking. So I pulled the rain fly off my head and shined my light up, and there was a bear like right there. Holy cow. That's really close. I didn't really let him get that close. It just so happened that he was already there when I woke up.
All right. Yeah, never a dull moment. Those are fun times to be able to look back on. Maybe not quite so fun in the moment, but to be able to reminisce about.
Oh, man, it was scary then, you know. I was really just kind of curious what he was going to do when I turned my light. Once I shined my light on him, I was like, what's next? You know, I had no idea.
Sure. Uh-huh.
You can only hope that he's going to run away.
Right. Smack him on the nose with your flashlight.
Right.
Yep. Right on. All right, Randy. Well, I got to about wrap this up. I got to go make some dinner for the kids there and get off to bed. I mean, it's early for me, early period. But man, I'm fading. I've had some long days. My wife is down in Costa Rica. We bought a little vacation rental down there, a condo, earlier this year. And so she took the two girls down. My son's out from college right now. And then my oldest of the younger three is here with me. So I'm kind of.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, running solo here. And she's down there for a couple months. And so I'm knocking out a bunch of the projects on the house here that have been kind of lagging on finishing here over the last year. So it's nice to kind of start chipping away at those, but I haven't been getting quite as much sleep as I should as a result.
Well, tell the family hi for me. Tell the kids hi for me.
Yeah, for sure.
And hopefully we can all get together one of these days. I'll be in town for the big rodeo just north of you there. So
excellent. Yeah, if you I don't know that you'll be down or make it down for the high country shoot coming up here in what is it, the third weekend of June, but that one's a must if you're at all in the vicinity.
Yeah, you know, I've been to the high country shoot years ago. This year I won't make it. I actually have I'm busy that weekend. I'm going to go work a rodeo event for the PBR that weekend. So bull riding event.
Right on. Well, good to talk to you again, Randy. It's been a long time since we caught up, and I look forward to doing that in person the next time.
Yes, sir. Let's do it.
Sounds great, Randy. Thanks a bunch.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe and take a few seconds to review the podcast and share it with your friends on your social media platforms. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic or a person you'd like to hear from in a future episode, please email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. You can further support the podcast by picking up a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or a window sticker from the Stalker store at stalkerstickbows.com. Thanks for your support. Too many years have passed me by.